Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, today we will be studying Sutta number 7 of the Majjhima Nikaya. It is called the Vatupama Sutta, the simile of the cloth. And this is, so it's a short sutta, but it's a sutta which is very compact in meaning, with very, very many rich layers of meaning, which have to be brought out and explicated. And so the sutta begins, well, the special importance of this sutta is that it introduces a class of the defilements that are called the upakilesas, 16 upakilesas, or minor corruptions of the mind. Minor defilements of the mind. And this set of 16 corruptions of the mind, this becomes a standard classification in Buddhist psychology. It becomes incorporated to some extent into the Theravada Abhidhamma, but also these mental defilements, these corruptions of the mind, also become incorporated even more extensively into the Sarvastivada Abhidharma. And they owe their origin to this particular sutta. This is the primary source for them in the Pali Canon. Okay, the sutta begins when the Buddha directly uses the simile that gives the sutta its name. There are some newcomers. Please make sure that they have the sheets, the handout sheets. Okay, the Buddha says, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye. It could be blue, yellow, red, or pink. It's actually a kind of crimson. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. And so the consequence follows that when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Okay, here what is meant by an unhappy destination, the Pali is dugati. Is an unfortunate realm of rebirth, an unfortunate destination after death. The word dugati is used as a technical term to mean rebirth in the three lower realms, the hell realms, the realm of the afflicted spirits, the realm of the animals. And so when the mind is defiled, if they're just little defilements in themselves, maybe on their own they will not be strong enough to lead to an unhappy destination, to an unfortunate rebirth. But when those defilements accumulate, build up, then they lead to unwholesome types of action. They motivate. In fact, this is almost invariably the case for anybody who is not consciously undertaking some kind of spiritual training. The mental defilements will build up. They're unobserved, uncontrolled, unregulated, and so they will naturally tend to motivate unwholesome bodily and verbal actions. Actions which violate the basic principles of ethics, morality. And so those unwholesome actions generate unwholesome karma, and it is that unwholesome karma that brings the unhappy or unfortunate type of rebirth. And then the contrary case, suppose a cloth were pure and bright, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, blue, yellow, red, or pink, it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination may be expected. Here the text uses for happy destination the word sukkati, which again is a technical term, meaning rebirth in one of the fortunate realms of existence. That is, rebirth in the human realm, and particularly under fortunate circumstances in the human realm, or rebirth in one of the heavenly realms, or rebirth above the sensual heavenly realms in the Brahma world, and above the Brahma world in the realm of the formless existence. But perhaps happy destination here could have a broader meaning and could also include nirvana, which is, it's a destination, though it's a destination outside the realms of rebirth. And so if we consider the simile, I think it needs a little elaboration, that the cloth that's defiled and stained is the ordinary mind, the untrained mind. But now, if the mind were defiled and stained by its own nature, then it would be impossible to remove those defilements and stains. But there's a sutta where the Buddha says, Pabhasaram bhikkhave idam chitam agantu kehi upakilis upakile sehi upakilitam, which means that the mind is luminous or radiant, but it is stained by, or it is stained or defiled by adventitious defilements, literally by defilements that arrive from the outside. So the defilements or stains are not intrinsic to the nature of the mind. This doesn't mean that the mind is some kind of eternally pure reality, some kind of permanent substantial reality, but just that the defilements are not intrinsic to the nature of the mind. The defilements arise, they've been arising through beginningless time, but by training, by creating the appropriate conditions, it is possible first to temporarily remove the defilements so that the mind comes to a condition of temporary purity or temporary luminosity, such as achieved in the jhanas or samadhi states. And then through developing further conditions, that is the wisdom of insight developed to the point where it reaches the world transcending stages of realization, it's possible to eradicate the defilements so that the mind then becomes like a cloth which has been completely purified, in which all of the defilements and stains have been washed off and can never return to the mind. And so when we begin the process of practicing the Dhamma, this is like beginning with this cloth that's defiled and stained. And so as we practice, then gradually what we are doing is clearing the mind of these defilements and stains that obscure it, the course of defilements and stains, so that it comes to a temporary state of clarity, of purity. And within that temporary state of clarity and purity, the insight, the wisdom can be generated that will cut off the defilements completely and permanently so that they no longer arise again. In fact, the simile of the cloth is used repeatedly in the text when it describes the initial attainment of stream entry. We find this, for example, in the Upali Sutta. This would be Sutta number 56. This is page 485. Here the Buddha is giving a talk to a householder named Upali. You see this 485, paragraph 18. Upali had been a follower of the Jains, and he came to the Buddha to debate with him, and the Buddha defeated him in debate, and so he realized that he can no longer uphold the teachings of the Jains. And now he places his confidence in the Buddha. And then the Buddha gives him a standard Dhamma talk, explaining first the benefits of giving, of virtue, the heavens, and so on. Then when he knew that the householder Upali's mind was ready, receptive, free from hindrances, elated and confident, he expounded to him the teaching special to the Buddhas, suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path. Then just as a clean cloth with all marks removed would take dye evenly, so too, while the householder Upali sat there, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dharma arose in him, all that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. So here, when Upali is sitting there listening to the Buddha's talk, and he gains this confidence in the Buddha, when his mind becomes elated, very receptive and clear, free from the hindrances, then it is like the clean cloth, which is free from these stains and these marks, and is able to take the dye evenly, to absorb the Buddha's disclosure of the Four Noble Truths. And by absorbing that disclosure, Upali can achieve the vision of the Dharma, that is the attainment of the first stage of enlightenment, the stage of stream entry. Okay, so I think that simile in connection with Upali, that the implications of that are reverberating in this paragraph here, that one has to begin by first removing these coarse stains of the mind so that the mind could absorb the truth of the teaching and thereby become permanently purified. Okay, so now in paragraph 3, the Buddha raises the question, what are these imperfections that defile the mind. And here we come to this list of the 16, they're called cittas upakilesa, which can be translated, I don't go along so much now with imperfections. That was Venerable Nyanamoli's choice. But I would prefer something like corruptions of the mind or defilements of the mind. And then I've compiled on this paper that I handed out, since in the Pali, in the Sutta text, we just have the words for them, and the meaning might have been clear in the time of the Buddha. These would have been words of everyday use, more or less everyday use. But even by the time of the commentators, 4th century BC, even the Abhidhamma Vitaka, some explanation, maybe this would be 3rd century BC, some explanation was felt necessary to clarify the meaning of some of these terms. And so I compiled this list of explanations of the terms from two sources. One is from the second book of the Abhidhamma Vitaka called the Vibhanga. This has a section, one chapter of the Vibhanga has not the 16 upakilesas as a list, but it has lists of defilements of the mind arranged in other categories, but many of them are the same as the ones that come in this list, and it gives definitions of them. But as you'll see, sometimes the Abhidhamma way of giving definitions are not all that helpful for us today. What they do is compile a list of synonyms, sometimes just taking words from different parts of speech that really are just the same word and different ways of expressing the same word. Then the other source of explanation that I drew upon is the commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya called Papanchasutani. This was written 5th century AD by Acharya Buddhaghosa, but he would have been drawing upon older sources, which would have gone back to, it could have even gone back to the time of the Buddha himself, perhaps the earliest parts of the commentary, but then developed over the centuries. Okay, so first we have in Pali abhijja visama lobha, which is translated here covetousness, that is abhijja, and unrighteous greed, literally uneven greed. And both of these are actually, in the technical way of explanation, typical of the Abhidhamma, both of these are two aspects of greed or craving. So the commentator wants to explain, if they are two aspects of greed or craving, what is the difference in aspect? And apparently different, by the time of the commentator, Buddhaghosa, different earlier commentators that to whose works he had access, to whose opinions he had access, had given somewhat different explanations. And so in his commentary, he includes the different methods of explanation. Okay, so we have one explanation. Abhijja, covetousness, means desire and lust for one's own belonging. I see some people writing here. Don't you have the sheets? Eva and Chilasa? Okay. That I gave out. You have it. Okay. If you want to write, write. but it's here. Okay. Okay, so this is one explanation. Desire and lust for one's own covetousness is desire and lust for one's own belongings. Then unrighteous greed is desire and lust for the belongings of others. Okay, that's the way one teacher, ancient teacher, would have explained. Then another teacher would have explained, covetousness means desire and lust for an object that is suitable, that is, it's a legitimate object. For example, okay, I need a new computer, somebody gives me a gift of a new computer, so I'm very happy with this. Wherever I go, I carry it around with me. I'm very, show it off to my friends. But don't show it off too much, since I don't trust them completely. When I go to sleep, I put it under my pillow. I wake up several times in the night, feeling with my hand, is it still there? When somebody else has a new computer, I start looking over, checking, just make sure it's not better than mine. Okay, so this is a suitable object that's obtained, but one is extremely attached to it. Then unrighteous greed, or illegitimate greed, this is desire and lust, craving, for an object that's unsuitable and has not been obtained. Something that might be illegal, or something that I have no hope of getting for myself, but I'm constantly yearning for it, and even planning and scheming for ways to get something which is illegal and illegitimate. But then there was one elder monk quoted by Venerable Buddha Gosa who says that there is no greed that is not unrighteous. So therefore, he says, greed itself is covetousness in the sense of longing, and also greed is unrighteous in the sense of being contrary to what is right. And according to this view, the meaning of covetousness and unrighteous greed is the same, but they're just differences in expression. But that seems to be a somewhat extreme view, which goes, in my view, against the sense of the text, since here visama lobha seems to be a special qualification, or unrighteous greed seems to be a special qualification of this greed. It's not, though of course every greed, all greed has to be eliminated, but here by unrighteous greed is meant a greed of especially obsessed, in my view, greed of especially obsessive kind, which goes against what is legitimate, what is appropriate. Okay, then, ill will. The commentary didn't give any real detailed explanation, since it assumes that this will be familiar to the reader, but it just mentions 9 cases of aversion, which have come down in there's a sutta about the 9 cases of aversion. I didn't look them up to refresh my memory. So I was in a hurry to type this. Well, I'll just leave it as assumed that we have a good idea what ill will is. Anger. Okay, this is the style of explanation that we come across in the Vibhanga. Part of it. See, it's a chain, a list of synonyms. So you get anger, being angry, angriness. They're just three Pali words which are variations on koda, kujana, kodi, tatang, something like that. Then the next three give some illumination to the meaning. Hatred, hating, hatefulness, irritation, irritability, irascibility, opposition, resistance. There were some more that I didn't put down. Displeasure of the mind. Okay, then the next one, upanaha. I think maybe Venerable Nyanamoli had used resentment, or perhaps I had used it back at that time. But from the commentarial explanation, or even both from the Abhidhamma and commentarial explanation, it seems something like hostility would be a better rendering. The Vibhanga says, in the past there was anger, later there is hostility. It is the accumulation, persistence, strengthening of anger. Then the commentary says, it is anger after it again and again envelops the mind. So maybe towards a particular person, anger will arise from time to time. But then if that anger becomes focused and fixated upon that person, so that it becomes a feeling of continued resentment towards that person, continued belligerence towards that person, then it is hostility, upanaha. Then the next corruption of the mind is called mukha, which comes from the root meaning is to smear. And so I've seen it also explained as denigration. But the explanation given by the Majjhima commentary indicates the sense is that it is a kind of denigration of someone who has previously done favors to oneself. Or it is, you could call it, contempt shown towards a benefactor. It gives the example in lay life of somebody who starts out in life in a disadvantaged situation from poor and humble circumstances, and then somebody else, out of compassion for this person, gives him benefits. This would be in the Indian social structure, heavily structured by way of classes. Somebody becomes his benefactor, promotes him, gives him good position, helps him maybe get an education, gives him some work to do within his own establishment, and that person shows initiative, intelligence, works his way up till he gets into a high position. Then he's able to continue working his way up the social scale till he gets in a really high position. And then at a later time, he looks back at his benefactor and says, what did he do for me? I accomplished this all by myself. And so he just spurns the benefits that he received from this person earlier in life. That's the example given from lay life. Then in the monastic life, the commentary gives the example of somebody who's ordained as a novice monk. Then his preceptor or teacher instructs him, trains him, guides him in the Dhamma. Then this young monk grows up. He gets the higher ordination. Maybe he becomes well known. He becomes a prominent preacher. Then he becomes an elder, great elder, and then very respected, highly esteemed. And so then he looks back at the elder who benefited him earlier, his teacher and preceptor, and says, what did they do for me? They didn't do anything. Okay, so that is contempt or denigration. The next one is called in Pali palasa. And the meaning of this, I used a rendering. Venerable Nyanamoli had used the rendering, or the original rendering, domineering. But from the explanation and the commentary, it seemed the meaning, something like insolence, would be more appropriate. Here, the commentary explains that this is, I'm not sure that sense of competitiveness is the appropriate rendering for this yuga gaha gahi, but it's a case where somebody who has, say, a little learning, then looks towards a highly learned person and thinks, what is the difference between you and me? What is the difference between you and me? I'm just as good as you are. And so maybe it's a sense of putting oneself up above others, even though one doesn't have the qualities which really entitle one to put oneself in that higher status. So I think something like presumption or insolence might be a suitable rendering. Okay, next comes Isa, which it's easily rendered as envy. And here we have another example of this style of Abhidhamma definition. The envy, envying, enviousness that arises towards the gain, honor, respect, esteem, veneration, and reverence shown towards others. Okay, next comes the quality called macharya, here rendered avarice, but I think avarice usually means a strong craving to get more, doesn't it? Is that the case? But this is, macharya is more the clinging, the holding to what one has, and the reluctance to, the unwillingness to share what one has with others. According to the definition in the Vibhanga, it's simply unwillingness to share. And according to the explanation of the Majjhima commentary, the inability to endure sharing one's own good fortune with others. The Vibhanga uses this explanation with reference to dwellings. Actually, this comes from in the context of monastic life. If a monk has some dwelling places, then he wants to hoard them all for himself. If other monks come, he doesn't want to make these cottages or rooms available to others. If he has families of supporters, then he doesn't want other monks to know about them because he wants to keep their support entirely for himself. If he gets gains, offerings, then he'll keep them hidden, secret. He doesn't want to share them with others. And similarly with praise, he doesn't want, if other people praise him, he doesn't want people who praise him to be known to others, since they might praise others and then he gets less praise himself. And then he doesn't want to share what Dhamma he knows with others, since he's afraid that if others come to know as much Dhamma that as he does, then they will become prominent preachers or writers on Dhamma, and so then his fame and esteem will diminish. And so there is this meanness or niggardliness regarding these possessions. Okay, the ninth is called Maya, which means deceit. Here the case is given, the Vibhanga says, somebody misbehaves with the body, by speech, by mind. And for the purpose of concealing it, he forms the evil wish, may others not know this of me. Okay, so this hiding or concealment of one's faults, of one's wrong deeds, this is deceit. And then the counterpart of this is satya, which is translated as fraud. And the explanation given in the commentary, the commentary uses this example of something called a long fish, ayatana macha. It's said to show its tail to fish and its head to snakes in order to make them think, I am just like you. And so a trickster shows himself to others and says to them, I will be your companion, your benefactor, and I will never desert you. And they think he is devoted to us, loyal to us. Maybe we could translate this a hypocrite, hypocrisy. Okay, then the next one is tamba. Tamba is, the word literally means stiffness, hardness. And so it's easily rendered, easily understood as obstinacy. And the commentary explains this as unyieldingness, rigidity. And it gives the example of a bellows filled with air, so that it's very hard. So you can't, there's no softness, no flexibility in a bellows when it's completely filled with air. It's like a football filled with air, very hard and rigid. No mellowness, no softness, no flexibility. Okay, number 12. Okay, the Pali is sarambha. Okay, and this is said to be have both unwholesome and wholesome varieties. For the unwholesome, okay, in the case of a layman, he sees another person dressed up in ornaments, and there arises in him the thought that he must surpass the other person twofold. If that person has so many ornaments, then I must get ornaments which are twice as expensive, or twice as fancy, or I must wear twice as many ornaments, or I must wear clothing that's twice as stylish, much more. It's a kind of need or wish to outshine others. And then the example given of a monk, he hears of another who has learned so much Dhamma or who can speak so much and then thinks he must outdo the other monk by learning twice as much or by being able to speak twice as much. But then it says that there are good varieties. When one layman sees another give a gift, and then purely from a desire to give, not from a wish to outdo the other, to bolster his own ego, then he thinks that he should give two or three gifts. Or when a monk sees another learn one Nikaya, and then not from conceit, but simply from a desire to learn, he thinks that he should learn two Nikayas, then it is wholesome. But as a defilement of the mind, the unwholesome type is intended. Okay, then number 13 is mana, which is conceit. Usually the texts speak about three types of conceit, at least three varieties. One is the conceit, I am better than others. Second, I am equal with others, just as good as others. And third, the conceit, the inferiority conceit, I am worse than others, not as good as others. But usually it refers to putting oneself, conceiving of oneself as being superior to others. And then when that conceit becomes extreme to the point that one becomes haughty and dismissive of others, then it becomes atimana. This is arrogance. Then the 15th is vanity, mudda. The word mudda actually comes from a root which means to become intoxicated. So intoxicants, things that one drinks, intoxicating drinks, are called mudja. And to become intoxicated through drinking intoxicants is mudjati. So this is a kind of intoxication which takes place on account of social class, family background, education. And in the suttas they speak about also about the vanity that occurs, or intoxication, in young people. They're intoxicated with their youth and they never think that they will grow old. In healthy people, they become intoxicated with their good health and never think of sickness. And during life, people become intoxicated with life and never reflect upon death. And then the 16th corruption of the mind is pamada, which comes from the same root as vanity, as mudda. You could see it in the word. The root is M-A-D, mud. So pamada is an intensification of this intoxication. But we render it usually as negligence. The commentary explains it simply as letting the mind roam among the objects of sensual pleasure. That might be too narrow an explanation. I would say that negligence would be allowing the mind to become overrun by the defilements without making any effort to restrain the mind and to train the mind. Now, having enumerated, let me just ask if there are any questions about these defilements of the mind. This is quite a chunk here. Yeah. Irascibility. Have you ever heard of irascible? No? It's somewhat like irritable, irritability. I had to use my own sort of ingenuity just to find synonyms for the chain of words that was given in the comment in the Vibhanga for anger. It gave irritation, irritability. Then the third one was something like, would have been like in that same, would have been a triad based on irritation, irritability. I think I tried irritableness, but it was rejected by the computer's spell checker. put the red line under it. Of course, I could have kept it anyway, since it would be intelligible, even though it might not be listed in the dictionary. So then I thought, what will work? And I tried a few others, and they were rejected too. Then somehow I came up with irascibility came to mind, and I put it in. But it means being disposed to anger. Do you remember them? I think you mentioned them in one of your talks. I'm sure you did in one of your talks. 9 cases. Okay. He did harm to me. Okay, now I know what they are. Okay. He did harm to me. He's doing harm to me. He will do harm to me. He did harm to those who are dear to me. He is doing harm to those who are dear to me. He will do harm to those who are dear to me. He benefited my enemies. He's benefiting my enemies. He will benefit my enemies. I think those are the 9 cases. Didn't you mention that? Yeah. They're actually thoughts that arise conditioning ill will, but the commentary just mentions them in order to show the different aspects, different ways in which ill will arises. Yeah, they seem somewhat close, but I think the difference is in the mode in which they arise. That palasa, this insolence, it's more like pushing oneself, and so that one is pushing oneself in the place of those who are better qualified, and almost insultingly, arrogantly, that connects it with arrogance, giving rise to such thoughts. So I have to say, I have little more to go on than the Pali word and the explanation in the commentary and in some cases in the Abhidhamma. Yeah. I say self-indulgence is symptomatic of negligence. But negligence is a psychological state. Self-indulgence is an action which originates from that psychological state. Okay, shall I go on then? Continue? Okay. Paragraph 4. Knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, or better, let's say simply, that is a defilement of the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. And so for all 16, through negligence as an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. Now, from the wording of this paragraph, one would not be able to get a clear idea exactly what is meant by abandoning it, if you remember, and to what extent it is abandoned. If you remember, I had given you a table, a chart, some weeks ago, months ago, about the different types of abandoning. Abandoning by temporary substitution, abandoning by suppression in the jhana, abandoning by eradication. According to the commentaries, and now here the author of the commentary, Venerable Buddhaghosa, is basing this upon an old tradition which would have come down through many, many generations of how to understand the sutta. According to this old, ancient method of explanation, what is meant by abandoning here is abandoning by eradication. And the eradication that takes place here, the monk who is being described is a monk who achieves the third stage of liberation, or the third stage of enlightenment, a monk within the scheme of the four stages of realization. There are some hints later in the sutta which seem to confirm this. But at this point, we don't see a direct statement to that effect, simply a statement that the monk abandons these defilements of the mind. But according to this method of explanation, the abandoning is abandoning by eradication, that he eradicates these defilements. So not in every case, as we'll see, completely. And the abandoning that takes place is the abandoning by the third level of liberation, which is the stage of non-returner. One who cuts off the lower five fetters, the fetter of identity view or view of self, fetter of doubt, fetter of clinging to rites and rituals or rules and observances, the fetter of sensual desire, the fetter of ill will. But he can't have completely eradicated all of these defilements. He cannot have completely eradicated all of these defilements in their entirety. And there's an important phrase that we'll come across a little later which indicates this. Now, but one reason why he cannot have abandoned all of these defilements completely is because some of these defilements, at least, can only be abandoned completely by an arahant. For example, conceit, mana, is abandoned only by an arahant. In my view, negligence, the last one, despite what the commentary says, can only be abandoned entirely by an arahant. And we'll see that the sutta will go on to describe the process by which this monk continues to engage in the practice to develop the path to arahatship. So the monk at this stage has to be short of arahatship. And yet by abandoning some of these defilements, he has to be higher than a stream enterer. Okay, now, when the monk has known that covetousness and unrighteousness as an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, when a monk has known that ill will, etc., right through to negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, he acquires perfect confidence in the Buddha thus. And here this is a very important phrase, so it's an imperfect rendering of that expression, perfect confidence in the Buddha. The Pali is... Here the Pali term is avecha pasada. Now, This is a compound. What kind of compound is it? Not a polyclass, this is a superclass. But it doesn't conform to any of our compounds that we've studied in the polyclass. This is called a syntactical compound. Okay. It's the compound of avecha plus pasada. Now, avecha, it's an interesting word. It's a prefix ava, which means, indicates down or under, plus the verbal root I, which has the sense of to go. So ava plus I, then it forms, from I you form the, or we form the gerund or absolutive, itya. Then ava plus itya becomes ava plus itya, then the ava plus the I join to make avecha. So avecha is under plus the root I meaning gone, so it has the sense of undergone, which, similar to the English word, when one undergoes something, it means one has experienced it. So this is confidence which arises by having experienced the truth of the Dhamma. The confidence that arises by having undergone realization of the truth of the Dhamma. So it's only of those who have achieved at least the first stage of enlightenment, the stage from stream entry upwards, that one can say they have avecha pasada, this perfect confidence. But other translators have used, this is better, unwavering confidence. In the Samyutta Nikaya translation, I think I've hit upon what I think is a much better rendering, confirmed confidence. It's confidence which comes through having confirmed to oneself the truth of the teaching. So now this disciple, this monk, apparently he's used some methods which are not explained, but apparently he's used some methods not explained in the sutta, but he's abandoned these defilements through realization of some stage of the Dhamma. From stream entry, probably, if the commentators are correct, up to non-returning. And through that realization, and through cleansing the mind permanently of these defilements, abandoning these defilements from the mind, he acquires this perfect confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. But I won't go at this point into the explanation of the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Time is running on, so I'll ask if there are any questions on what we've covered so far. Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's the instrumental. But this is the stem form. Suki? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, the question is the word that I'm using, bahana, as abandoning, is it the same as the word that's used in the sutta, when the sutta speaks about abandoning? The word that's used in the sutta is the verb form, pajahati. But pajahati, from the verb pajahati, one gets the noun pahana. They're noun and verb based on the same root. So it's really the same word in verb form and a noun form. Jim, did you have a question? When I speak about eradication, eradication is something that goes further and deeper than just non-attachment. But what is meant here by eradication is that through wisdom, through the development of wisdom, one has actually cut out the very roots of these states so that they can never arise again in the mind. Repeat the question, I didn't quite catch it. Yeah. The question, are the roots there in the sense of some kind of essence? When one speaks about the roots still existing, this is a somewhat, it's a metaphorical way of speaking. What one would say is that until the wisdom, this particular stage of enlightenment is reached, there is, say, the disposition for these states, the possibility for these states to arise in the future. It's not that, like the root of a flower, the root of a tree, that there's something actually physically existing in the mind, or even mentally existing in the mind. But it's just that the capacity is there, the disposition, the possibility. A choice I didn't... Yeah. 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 Let us say that as long as the dispositions are there, again, this is a metaphorical way of speaking, then these states can still arise in the future. And as long as these states can still arise in the future, then one is not able to realize nirvana. So, to realize nirvana, one has to develop the wisdom of these stages of enlightenment, stages of realization, which cuts off the roots, the dispositions for these states to arise. And when these states are completely, the dispositions for these states are completely destroyed, obliterated, uprooted, then that is, you could say, the realization of nirvana. And maybe what's the radical and sort of unfamiliar idea here is the possibility that it is actually possible to completely eliminate, say, ill will and anger. Like what we're taught is that the most we can hope for is that we could control it, and maybe with some effort we can develop a mind of goodwill so that the tendency to goodwill will not become very prominent within our minds. And maybe some people are just born lucky, so they naturally have a very cheerful, friendly, happy temperament, and they don't give way to ill will, not so often, though if you prick them hard enough, they'll show some little spurts of anger or irascibility. But according to the Buddha's teaching, it's actually possible to eliminate these states completely. And those who have reached that stage of where these defilements are completely eliminated, completely eradicated, they are what we call Aryan persons, noble ones. We call them sages or saints. Any further questions?
Well, it's following you exactly, but paragraph 5 you were saying
that... It's actually paragraph 4. Yeah. In paragraph 4, it's a very short paragraph, especially in this abridged version, which speaks about the monk abandoning the 16 imperfections of the mind. Okay, so the question comes up, what type of abandoning is this? Of course, the texts speak about abandoning imperfections of the mind. Different texts speak about abandoning the imperfections of the mind. So this can be by, according to context, by way of, what was the expression I used in that chart? I don't have it in front of me. Do you have it there? By factor substitution? No.
I guess my question is, in this chart you're showing now, different stages, different ones are abandoned.
Yeah.
But in this paragraph, they're all abandoned. If they're all abandoned,
they already had a harvest. Yeah, but it's not the case, because there is a word, an expression, which will come in paragraph 8, which indicates that in the case of some defilements, the abandoning is complete. But in the case of others, the abandoning is only up to a certain extent, not yet complete. So even though the text speaks about abandoning it, because later on, paragraph 8 speaks about, okay, I'll jump the gun, and I won't explain it, but I'll introduce that expression. It says, when he has given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished these defilements of the mind. Here it's translated in part, but the Pali is yet odi. It's better. It's up to a limit. Up to a limit. So it means the implication is that he hasn't really abandoned them, all of them in their entirety. But some of them, because he's a non-returner, yet not yet an arhat, some of them he's abandoned only, say, 75%.
Well, we're still talking about
exactly, yeah. Yeah. But some of them have been abandoned by eradication. And in this, the back of the page that I gave out, I should say also, where I say the elimination of defilements by the supermundane paths, according to the Majjhima Nikaya commentary. I'm going to come to this next week, but I should say I don't completely agree with the commentary. And I'm not alone in that. I have some even venerable, the famous Burmese meditation master, Upandita Soyador. He also disagreed with the commentary on some of these points. So I don't feel like I'm out in left field in that opinion. Okay, I think we'll have to stop now, and then we'll continue this very, it's a very dense and very rich sutta
next week.
Okay, we do the dedication of
the merit.
Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe